Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte. Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte, dann werden Sie sehen, Herr Reporter, wie das sich damals entwickelt hat. Wie das sich damals entwickelt hat.
Hello and welcome to Geschichten aus der Geschichte. The fact that this intro is in English might have tipped you off that this is no ordinary episode. It is a very special episode, actually, because I'm with a special guest. I'm joined today by none other than Dr. Emma Southern. Welcome.
Hello. It's so lovely to be back.
Yes.
It feels like such a long time.
It feels like such a long time. It's only been 3 years. In the greater scheme of things, that's nothing.
Yeah. For a Roman historian, that's a blink of an eye.
Exactly. Now, just for those who are not familiar with you, or even those who are familiar with you, we've had you on this podcast twice already. The first time was when we talked about Agrippina the Younger, and the second time was when we talked about a murder in Rome. And both of these were inspired by books you wrote. The first one about Agrippina, and the second one was called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Murder in Ancient Rome. Today, as promised at the end of our previous chat, you are here to talk about your third book, which came out last year. And it's called A History of the Roman Empire in 21 Women, or for our North American listeners, I think it's called A Rome of One's Own.
Yes, they gave it the sexier title, and the British title is much more what it says on the tin. But but they are both the same book, both 21 women that I chose that people will not have heard of ideally, or will not be hugely familiar with from the Roman world, starting at the very beginning with the foundation of Rome, and then going all the way through to the kind of arbitrarily chosen end of the Western Roman Empire.
Galla Placidia is actually the only one I was familiar with.
Yeah, she's much more famous, I find, in kind of continental Europe than she is in the Anglosphere, like the English-speaking, because she has such a relationship with the Goths. And in Barcelona, they're very into her. There's like a Galla Placidia Square. And so she's like, there's loads of novels about her, I found out, in Spanish. And she's very famous in like the non-English-speaking world, but in I found in the English-speaking kind of people who have never heard of her, basically. Mm. They're like, unless they have been to see her mausoleum, then in Ravenna. But other than that, they have no idea who she is. Mm. So there's a kind of a big divide between people who only read English and people who can read other languages.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that nobody heard of her in the English-speaking parts of the world, combined with the fact that all the other women, or most of the other women that are in your book, that nobody has ever heard of before, or very rarely, it shows that you didn't choose for your book the most well-known women of the ancient world. So it's not that you chose the empresses or the queens, or mainly the warriors, but you try to pick women who were known for other things and who are not necessarily featured in the ancient histories, for example.
Yeah. So there are two reasons for that. Firstly, I think that if you go for the obvious women, you end up doing only empresses and queens, and occasionally a kind of warrior woman who is usually also framed as a queen, like Boudicca, who is in there, but only so I could do Cartamantua. You end up then basically saying that the only way to be important in history is to fit into these specifically masculine frameworks of what importance is. You have to be in politics, or you have to be in war, and ideally you have to be good at those things. And that just feels really like limiting to me, to say that there is only one way to be important. And what you get then is not a history of kind of women in the world, but a history of queens who don't really have anything in common with real people. Like the concerns of the royalty are not the concerns of me. And so it's like what you're doing is telling a different story. So I really wanted to not do just empresses. There's a couple in there, but only weird ones. And also, I think that if I had done women that everybody has heard of, like some people people get like, why is there no Livia in here? Or why is there no, you know, my favorite woman? Is that if you do women that people have already heard of, then it gives the impression that those are the only women that we know about, that we can only tell stories about those women because they're the only people who left a record. But actually, I could have done a history of the Roman Empire in 1,000 women, but I don't know that anyone would have published it. But there are so many women that I had to kind of cut more than I would have loved to have. And there are so many different stories from all over the empire of people living completely different, diverse lives, and all of these different types of womanhood that get completely eradicated by stories that are just about the same old women over and over again. And if I had done Livia, then I might have had to cut like Julia Balbia or Julia Felix, or one of the ones that you won't have heard of and you won't be aware that we even know anything about these people, but we do.
Which kind of leads me to something you wrote about in your introduction, and I'm fairly certain you, in every interview you've had to you've had to talk about this. I'm obviously talking about the famous anecdote from the 1970s, which I think is attributed to Amy Rishlin.
It is, yeah.
About studying the lives of women in ancient Rome. Could you just, for our audience, quickly paraphrase this anecdote, and what I'd be interested in, what do you think has changed in between then and now, so that we have books like yours, for example?
So the anecdote is told by Amy Rishlin in one of her books. Amy Rishlin is she is still working. She's not even really retired in that way that academics never really retire. But she's still around. She is kind of the first wave of historians in and classicists who started writing about women, because they were among the first wave of women studying ancient history and studying classics. And when she was an undergraduate student at the Ivy League university that she went to, her and some of her kind of fellow undergraduates approached their head of department and said, we would really just like a course on, you know, what are women doing at this time? It would be really nice to know what about women in the ancient world and women in the ancient literature, because, you know, they are there when you're reading the sources and it would be nice to talk about them. Hmm. And he said that he may as well do a course on Roman dogs, because it was just of no interest or worth to him to explore what women are doing. The important thing to him was, what are men doing about it? Was war, it was politics, it was rhetoric and philosophy. And those were the things that he considered to be worthy of study. And Amy Rishlin went on to basically invent the entire field of looking at women, along with several other people, kind of formed a group. Mary Beard is another one of them. She was right at the forefront of this kind of work of saying that women are interesting to talk about, and kind of pushed through the political changes that were happening at the time into classics and into studying ancient history. So she was kind of coming up into her career in the 1970s. And so the revolutions that were happening in the real world took some time for them to filter into studying ancient history. But because of basically the activism of people like her and like Mary Beard, of repeatedly turning up to conferences and repeatedly writing papers saying, actually, maybe it is really interesting to see how Ovid writes about women and to think about how that impacts people, it caused what's called kind of the cultural turn and made people stop looking just at the very highest level of society and considering only what the Romans themselves thought were important to write about, but to look kind of beneath that and to look to the side of it and to say, what's going on around Tacitus writing the Annals? What's going on around Ovid writing the Ars Amores? And who is reading it, who's looking at it, and to kind of think about the world as much bigger and containing multitudes rather than containing 25 white guys in togas talking to each other.
So I'm wondering, for you, for example, when you start writing about these women that are in your book and that don't necessarily feature very strongly in the written sources. How do you deal with incomplete or biased sources, like these gaps? How do you fill those? Is there like a certain methodology you employ?
I think everybody has their own method. Amy Richlin, again, is super helpful at this. She has a method that she calls the Forbidden Planet method, which is, if you've ever seen Forbidden Planet, there is a bit where the kind of robot monster is invisible, and the only way they can see it is by shooting it from various different angles. Okay. With light, basically, and the lasers bounce off of it, and they can see where the light is not going. And from that, they can see the shape of the monster. And so that's basically her approach, which is that if you kind of come at the idea of woman from as many different angles as you possibly can, then you can kind of see the shape in the middle.
Okay.
The other way, the way that I do it is to just really acknowledge the gaps and then think about why we have those gaps. So we have like incomplete stories of a lot of women. And why are those stories incomplete, basically? And what does that tell us about what Roman culture, for example, thought was important about women, or what Roman cultures, what they thought was important to inscribe on the world, and what was left off? And I also think that just acknowledging the gaps and saying, like, we can imagine this, or they're right, we can kind of think that maybe this is a guess that XYZ could have happened, but honestly, we don't know. And we don't know because nothing else is left from the archaeological record. Yeah. Or the only way that we know this person is because she wrote four poems on the side of a wall. Or, you know, in this source, like when we're talking about Boudicca and Cartamandua, for example, or Zenobia, like they're only written about in two sources and they are both very biased, but we acknowledge the bias, but this is what we've got. So we have to kind of work with it. So I think acknowledging the bias and acknowledging the gaps and being completely upfront that we know that this is incomplete and often inconsistent, but that we're all making subjective judgment calls about it is the way that I work.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the job of the historian, right?
Yeah, it is.
You have to be the one who sort of puts these pieces together and makes, I don't know, an educated guess about things.
Yeah. And I think that for a long time there was this idea, and there still kind of is around and about, that history should be or could be somehow objective, and it could be describing facts in some way, as though there aren't multiple layers of human interpretation between whatever happened and what we have access to, and then how I am presenting it to you. And it's not in any way an objective science or something that you can be factual about even necessarily, unless you are literally telling people names and dates. Right. As soon as you are trying to tell a story, then you are interpreting. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that interpretation and to say, you know, this is my understanding of it. This is the way that I assess this and my subjective opinion on it. Other opinions are available. And if you want to see them, then you can see, you know, this person has argued the complete opposite. but this is what I think about it. And you're reading my book. So.
which I personally find is, you know, one of the most interesting aspects about history. And that with time and with more information we get are also shaped differently now than they were 20 years ago.
Yeah. And they will be in 20 years time, they will be shaped completely differently again. And we'll be able to have even like conversations that we're not even imagining right now about basically the exact same sources. or we might get new sources and that'd be amazing. And yeah, that kind of argument and discussion and kind of feeling changing about things is what is interesting about history to me. And then like discovering a piece of new information and it changing your feelings about something completely is amazing. My friend Innes calls it being a time detective. And he gets really frustrated by books where they hide the time detective part, as he calls it. He's like, he wants to know, like, where did you get this information? What kind of source is it? Where did it? How did, you know, is it contemporary? Is it not? Is it? He wants to know all of that stuff. What do other people think about it? Right. And I feel the same. Like, I want to, the finding clues part and putting it all together in order to make a case is the fun part.
Right. Which reminds me, like, a couple of episodes back, I did an episode on the battle at Thermopylae. Which is a great example for that, because, you know, the main source we have is Herodotus. And yeah. Herodotus, I mean, he's more like, I think I heard you talk about his source in an interview and liken it to sort of historical fiction. And that's what he is. And he's very bound to the, you know, the literary traditions, obviously, of his time. So reading what he wrote about the battle is kind of like, you know, doing this time detective thing. Like, why is he writing about this in that way? And why is he doing this? Obviously, he's writing it way after it happened. So he's already influenced by whatever became of Sparta as sort of the mythological city state and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I think this is sort of a really prime example for that kind of thing. Which leads me to a similar question when it comes to sources, because you have some elite women in your book, but you have also some who are non-elite women. How much more difficult is it to sort of reconstruct the lives of these women as compared to those who at least in some way show up in the written sources?
You get different details is the thing. In the written sources, what you get often is a lot of personality. Because a lot of the, like, Roman written sources are quite interested in psychology and in personality and in this idea that people have, like, a character that is fixed. And so if you're writing about elite women, then often you get things that they've said, you get good quips, you get often very scandalous stories about them, or something that they are... something particularly amazing that they are said to have done, but very often you'll get something that they've said. And then, like, the thing that I always think of when I think of Livia, for example, is the story that when Tiberius refused one of her nominations for a magistrate, she got out a load of letters that Augustus had written while he was alive about how much he didn't like Tiberius, and then chased him around the house reading them aloud to him, which I think just tells you an awful lot about Livia. Right. And how she is as a mother and how she feels her role is. And so you get a lot of kind of personality in that way. Whereas if you have kind of archaeological records, they're so much more limited, because 99% of the time you'll have just one fragment of what they have said or done, and it will just be a tiny snapshot of their life. So, for example, the Vindolanda letters, you have like two letters that are written to Sulpia Lepidina that are from Claudia, and they give you like just the tiniest little glimpse into this one moment in both of their lives where they are both living on the border of the British Empire, border of the Roman Empire in Britain. And, you know, you see nothing else about how they got there, how they feel about anything, how they experience their position as the wives of the commanders of these fortresses. All you know is that they're friends and they hang out, and one of them has children. But you get an intimacy that comes from that being their direct letters that you do not get in the texts, because in the texts you only ever get women mediated by men writing about them. And in the records that are left behind by women themselves in archaeology, so like those letters, or like the building that Julia Felix built, or the poems that Julia Balbia left behind, then you get a completely unmediated way that they lived in the world. And they didn't necessarily create these things for a reader. They created them for just to exist in the world. And so you get a smaller but more authentic look at a person.
So which type of sauce do you prefer then?
Oh, no, that's like choosing between children. I mean, I think that it's often more fun to write the ones from literature because you have, you know, quotes and you can write it almost in a novelistic style. But the intimacy of archaeological finds and the knowledge that this was, you know, like the Vindolanda letters, when you see them, that you can see where the hand changes and where Claudia has written with her own hand that she is looking forward to seeing Sulpicia. And there is it's a completely like very immediate, intimate experience to know that this is the object and there is nothing in between, kind of apart from about 2,000 years, nothing in between me and her, really. And I find them more emotionally powerful.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've already mentioned her, Julia Felix. Let's focus on her a bit, because I think she's really fascinating. And from what I've heard, many people you talk to think she's fascinating.
Yeah.
For various reasons. And she's a very good example of, you know, the kind of person who wasn't written about in ancient literature, or even written about at all until hundreds and hundreds of years later. And the only reason that we know of her is because she put up an ad in her hometown of Pompeii.
At the exact right time, she put up, for us anyway, she put up an ad on the outside of the building that she owned that advertised it as a complex to be rented. So she said that it was for rent for 5 years. It is a complex containing baths fitted for the kind of well-heeled, so fancy baths, shops with living quarters above them, and apartments and you can rent them for 5 years from her, and she's not going to run them anymore. And then it says in the building of Julia Felix, daughter of Spurius. So very conveniently, we had her name, and we had exactly what the space was that was being uncovered. It was actually uncovered before the sign was uncovered, because in Pompeii they uncovered the buildings before they uncovered the streets, because streets don't tend to have cool stuff in them. So kind of early archaeologists, when Julia Felix's building was first discovered in 1755, and so those, it wasn't even really archaeology, it was just digging, and then they did some terrible things to her stuff and cut it up and threw bits away. But it wasn't until a long time after, until about 200 years after, that they actually started digging up the street and found this to rent sign painted on the outside and were like, oh, okay, that's what this building is, because it doesn't look like a house. It looks weird. And it's actually two lots put together. So it's much bigger than anything that is around it. You can see from when they get down through the layers of archaeology that a road has been moved in order to knock these two lots together so she can expand it. And nobody really understood what they were looking at necessarily until they found this sign outside that explained that what it is basically like a miniature shopping center and entertainment complex, which right by the amphitheater, so pretty much next door. And it is like a little space where you can go, and it's got a hot food stand and really nice bars that fit kind of 9 or 10 people in them, that have this lovely black and white mosaic work. It's got these beautiful gardens with fish ponds and a little shrine to Isis, and then these little shops along the side, and then a dining room in the middle of it, with a water feature, which is very fancy, and all of these paintings of a kind of imagined version of what Romans thought Africa looked like, which involved hippopotamuses and pygmies mostly.
And one of the main parts of the building were these baths that you mentioned earlier. And what Julia Felix had created here, it's a commercial bath. It's not a public bath like the like the Stabian Bath, I think it's called, which I think is right along the same road.
It is. So it's not like your big public baths where anyone who can afford the penny to get in can go. This is a nice kind of semi-exclusive bath where you can pay. It's not as exclusive as having your own baths or having access to private baths, but it is, you're only going to have a few people in there, and it's not going to be a situation where you're stuck in there with 150 other people who you causing all kinds of mayhem as they do in the public bars, but or kind of pushing through crowds. This is a nice, exclusive. It's like going to the nice gym instead of the council gym.
Right. So you mentioned earlier that her name on the ad is Julia Felix, son of Spurius. And if I've read this correctly, I mean, it's not entirely clear, but Spurius means illegitimate child, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, so it's kind of an unknown. So
it's not actually her father's name, but it's just nobody knows who's talking.
Yeah, so it might mean that, I mean, it might be her father's name, but it also does mean kind of like, yeah, that she could be an illegitimate. There's all kinds of theories based on not a lot of evidence, I would say, because it was a time in the 19th century when people liked to use their imaginations a lot. there are all kinds of theories about her being born in Rome and then coming down to Pompeii after the earthquake in 62. So about a decade before decade and a half before the final destruction of Pompeii, there was an earthquake and a lot of land went up for sale. And there's these theories that she moved down from Rome in order to take advantage of it. But I've yet to discover where they have developed this narrative.
What I was wondering when I read it was, so if it's true that she's an illegitimate child, or why would she put it in the ad?
I think that this is basically a signifier. It's basically like having a surname. So it's Julia Felix, daughter of Spurius, not Julia Felix, daughter of Marcus.
Right. So in case there were others who were owning a property in Pompeii with the
same. So you know exactly which Julia Felix you are going to. And you do see, you know, often on the way that Romans will define themselves if they are not from a family. So we're very used to the tria nomina, the three names. And for girls in the elite families to just have a name that is their family name, so to be called Julia or Claudia or Agrippina, you know, these are ways basically of telling everybody what family you belong to. But if you don't belong to a big family, then generally the way of identifying yourself as this Julia rather than that Julia, or of, you know, being this person rather than that one, this Emma rather than that Emma, is to say who your father is and to say, I'm Emma, the daughter of Jeff, which you still see in, you know, Nordic countries as basically the same Magnus Magnusson type thing.
I mean, in your case, it could be like Emma from the south.
Yeah, exactly, which is almost certainly what my name means, judging by the results that my family have done from just literally just people from the south all the way down back. So, yeah. But yeah, it's basically, you know, that's how they identify precisely which person you are talking about.
So let's assume that her origins were relatively humble, which wouldn't be, you know, preposterous to assume.
No.
What does her ownership and development of such a big property, what does it suggest about the social mobility and entrepreneurship for women in Pompeii at that time?
I think the main thing that it shows is that that is something that is available to women. And you see a lot of stuff in Pompeii which shows that women were very much involved in the business of everyday life and in the business of provincial towns in the Roman Empire. That we are very used to this idea that comes from elite women, which is that elite women didn't do business, that they were banned from doing anything without the say-so of a guardian, of a male guardian. They were perpetually minors unless they had had three children. And this idea that women are barred from public life in pretty much every way, but often that comes from sources that are exclusively talking about the most elite women, where their engagement with public life would be the Senate or business on a grand scale, not owning what is basically a small business. Like, right. It's she clearly owns a building. She has access to money to expand it and do it up, but it is basically an individual small business. And the fact that she is running this place, is expanding it, is renting it out, presumably so that she can go off and do something else, or just wants to live in relaxation without managing the place. And then you see people like Yu Makia as well, who builds a big building in the Forum. And then there's a statue of her. And these are women who are very much involved in the in public life, who are not kind of locked at home, not doing anything, or they're not, you know, tied to some kind of domestic sphere. But when you get to the, what you might call the kind of middle classes or the plebeian classes that are outside of the senatorial and equestrian elite, you see that women's lives are incredibly active. They're very much involved in the economic life of the towns and cities that they live in. And that is fine, that is just an average thing that happens, and it's not some kind of big shock. But those ideals that I think that we imagine as being central to Roman womanhood are actually only, or at least mostly, applicable to Roman elite womanhood. That they are not really, they don't, obviously don't completely apply to every single class, and that actually women are very, it is possible and totally acceptable for women to be living economic public lives.
I think that's especially interesting because what we learn generally about society in ancient Rome is always informed by these depictions of the elites, obviously, because that's what's reflected in the sources. And we sort of get probably a skewed picture of what life was actually like, because the things we're familiar with are they had lots of slaves and they had very rich people who did this or that, but we have nothing that gives us an idea of what actual life is like. Like, you know, it happens even when you study, I don't know, the Middle Ages, and you have these, what you have are usually documents or laws that are still available, and you think, okay, society lived according to these laws, but then when you find sources where they talk about how law was actually enacted, you realize, okay, this is sort of the ideal, or this is how they wanted it to sound, but that's not how it happened.
Yeah, and law is another thing that people always refer to a lot with everything involving the Roman world, because we have the Digest and all of Justinian's excellent work. It feels like you have loads of, this is how the world was. Obviously, it says right here, women are not allowed to, go to the Forum or whatever. Law does not describe the world. Law describes how the person who wrote the law wishes the world was. Everybody has broken at least one law at some point. And some laws are enforced very heavily and some laws aren't. And some laws kind of fade away, but they still remain on the books. And law is a sphere of writing that can be applied in the real world, but does not necessarily mean that it actually is. And it's like, I always think of, you know, it's illegal, for example, for children under 18 to drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes. Right. And you're hard pressed generally to find a child, certainly where I grew up, who hadn't drunk alcohol and smoked a cigarette by the time they were 18.
You're in Northern Ireland, right?
Yeah, I grew up in England, but okay. It's no
same
different
thing, I think,
here. Yeah.
When it comes to underage drinking and smoking.
When it comes to underage drinking, there is no difference. And, and it's pretty socially acceptable. Nobody is going to ring the police and throw you into prison. If they did, then the police were not going to come and get you. And if you weren't running around town, then everybody is basically fine with it. And so there is a very firm line between things that are forbidden in law and things which are actually socially fine. And this is, you know, one of those things whereby the law has a very clear line, but social practice is that, sure, fine.
Right. Which leads me to another aspect of the estate of Julia Felix, which was uncovered, which I think quickly mentioned in, no, you didn't now, but you mentioned in your book, obviously, the frieze. So in the in the atrium of her bath, there was a big frieze on the wall that was uncovered, I think, in 1755. Parts of it were taken to, I think, Italy.
Yeah, they uncovered this frieze. It was found, the whole area was found by a farmer. And then when they started digging, they found this beautiful frieze, very brightly coloured, very detailed, and took it to the king, who lives down in Naples at the time. And he was like, I love it. I want it on my wall. It doesn't quite fit on my wall, though. So if we could just cut off some bits. So they trimmed it to size and then threw away the bits that didn't fit, which is the kind of thing that just makes you feel a bit sick. But thank God the rest of it was not thrown away and did survive, because it is a pretty much unique depiction in Roman art and surviving Roman art of what is obviously supposed to be a very realistic scene. And it is a painting of the Forum on market day in Pompeii, with lots of just very natural scenes of what people do in the Forum. So there's people like looking at fabric. There are people selling objects, so selling tools and selling pots and pans. There's my kind of favorite bit is that there's three women sitting in a circle, and one of the women has a baby on her lap, and there is a shoe salesman showing them shoes, and they're kind of examining the shoes and deciding if they like them. But then there's also people looking at the notices that are up in the Forum, and people in a school situation. So there's children clustered around a teacher. There is two depictions of men or boys being beaten, which, having written a book about murder, did not surprise me, but the kind of graphicness of it, it's just always never really stops being vaguely shocking how much Romans loved putting violence on things. And so there's that. There's a like what looks like a beggar or a homeless man, or at least a very poor man, who's got a little dog on a string in torn clothes, who is being given a coin by a well-dressed woman. There's somebody like sketching, and it's just like this really natural, almost like as close really as you can imagine the Romans would get to a photograph of what it is like to be in the Forum on a busy day when there is politics happening, there's you know, commerce happening, but it is all people. There's nobody there really in a toga. There's only one magistrate, and everybody is the kind of person who can afford to give away a little bit of money to someone who is poorer than them, and who can afford to buy nice coloured cloth, or who can afford to send their children to school, but are not so rich that they can do these things in-house. Mm-hmm. So the very elite, very rich people would have people in their house who weave fabric for them, and would have a personal tutor, and would have people who bring them things. They don't need to go out to purchase stuff. But this is the kind of people that the sort of middle classes who have enough money to buy things and to do charity, but not so much money that they can do it on a grand scale. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really unique kind of glimpse at probably like the most invisible part of Roman life, which is people who just lived very ordinary lives. Mm-hmm. And people like Julia Felix, who presumably like ran their own businesses or were artisans and, you know, were bakers and greengrocers and things, and did well enough out of it, but not so amazingly that they owned a villa and 100 people.
Which in turn helps us imagine who the people were that actually went to Julia Felix's bath, right?
Yeah.
Because she might have put it up for the same kinds of people who actually frequented her business.
Yeah. So they can come and see themselves, basically, and say, this is, and the whole experience of being there is very much experiencing luxury for a price. It's like going to a very, very nice restaurant or a
spa or something.
Yeah, or taking yourself for a spa day and experiencing, because what you get with money is, and this is what you get in the Roman world as well, but in an urban environment, what you get with money is you get peace, you get green space, and you get people bringing you stuff rather than you having to get your own stuff. And so what you get when you go to Julia Felix is you get a bit of privacy in the baths and in the gardens that she has. Like, they're not massive. You can walk across them in a few, like 10, 15 steps, but it is still more peaceful than a public park or even out on the street, especially out on the street because it's a busy street. And you can do reclined dining there. So her dining room is a space where you can go for a really special occasion and do reclined dining and pretend that you are the fanciest person. Because in order to do reclined dining, which is only available to rich people, you need enslaved people to be bringing you stuff, because one hand is propping you up and you're lying down and you only have one hand to take little morsels and eat them. And so you need somebody to be bringing you the plates, to be taking those plates away again, to be tidying up, to be bringing it back round again. And so that's something that normal people can't do. Normal people eat either, they dash in and out of a hot food stand and eat on the street, or they can go and sit down in one, but they don't eat by lying on their side and having people bring them delicious morsels. But she obviously has a space where you can do that for one night only, for like a birthday or an anniversary or a religious occasion, in the exact same way that I go to like very nice restaurants when I'm celebrating something and go and have like a ludicrous 7-course tasting menu. But that's not what I do on an average day.
Of course not.
Yeah. If only.
Yeah, I've yet to do a reclined dining. I don't think I've ever done that.
I don't think I ever have, actually. I imagine it's actually quite difficult.
Yeah, it's because like you always need that one hand to prop you up. It probably falls asleep at some point and you're like, can we switch sides? But then, you know, that doesn't
work. You can't really, because then you're very close to everybody and you have to. I do just often feel like my arm would get tired.
Speaking of clothes, one interesting aspect of the bath is it had its own latrines, which held enough space, or had enough space for up to 9 people, I think.
9 people. I mean, a mere 9 people.
Yeah.
Because you see some of those big public baths and they hold about 25.
But it means you're not alone on the toilet.
No. No, rarely you're alone on the toilet in the Roman world. If you're out and about, then it's a very public place. There's a great Martial poem about a guy who hangs around in the public toilets all the time because he's waiting for somebody to invite him for dinner. Toilets are like a social space where you can go and meet people and have a chat and then maybe invite someone to dinner or get an invite to dinner.
You know, it's kind of intriguing. I'm wondering, you know, what our society would be like if we'd kind of kept that mindset. You
know? If we had, I mean, I feel like there is a real intense intimacy to a lot of Roman social occasions whereby they are like, there can be very little shame about the body. And if there is, then often you'll get called out for it, at least amongst like the poets do. Like if somebody keeps their pants on while they're bathing, then somebody will write a hilarious poem about how they're weird. But they, you know, they bathe together and that's very social, and they're nude while they're doing that. And then they are going to the toilet together, so everybody knows everything about what everybody's bodily functions are and who's eaten well and who hasn't. And then when they eat together, they're often, if they are doing reclined dining, then they are lying next to each other. They're basically spooning in kind of groups of 3. And there is a real kind of physical intimacy to Roman sociality a lot of the time. And they kiss as well. This is the other thing that you never see on the TV. They're always doing that weird handshake that got made up where they don't even touch hands. They like grab each other's forearm. But like the traditional method of Roman greeting is a kiss on the lips. or a kiss on the hand if you are in like the in a lower social circle, but they're very much very close, very intimate, very touchy-feely, and have all seen each other's dicks.
How do we know that, actually? Like, how do we know that they kissed and that they saw each other naked a lot? Do we know this from archaeological sources, or is this, I don't know, written down somewhere, like the proper etiquette?
It is written down, not so much the proper etiquette, but kind of the reverse. So a lot of poetry and things will, so you get things like Martial and Juvenal and Catullus as well, who a lot of their poems are written to kind of make fun of people in their social circle. And so they will make fun of people that are doing things that they think are odd. And mm-hmm. so, for example, they'll be like, why don't you kiss me anymore? Do you think you're better than me now? Mm-hmm. Like, or they will say, so there's a series of Martial poems about women that want to have sex with him, or that he wants to have sex with, but that won't go to the baths with him. And so he's like, what's weird about your body that you won't show me before we have sex? And so from that, you know that at least some people were going to the baths with women and they were all being naked together. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a precursor to having some kind of sexual relationship. Right. And there's another one which is about a guy who takes one of his slaves, and the slave has a metal cover on his penis. And he's like, it's Marshall's basically says it's really weird that we're all here uncovered and that guy isn't. Like, what are you covering up? And so you get these, like, you find out what is the norm by what gets called out as weird for comedy purposes.
Mm-hmm. But the image of one's own body, or even someone else's body, that was very important in ancient Rome,
yeah.
right? So when people went to the bath, they looked around a lot.
Oh, yeah, they looked around a lot. And then they presented their own bodies as well. So there's a lot of plucking of hairs and of which they did pluck, because a lot of the times when they're talking about it, they talk about plucking hairs from their chest, plucking hairs from their legs, plucking their pubic hair. And you're like, I know that you can shave, like you talk about shaving all the time. they just seems like torturing themselves. But yes, and so there's a lot of shaping the body. And then baths are also gyms. So they do boxing, they'll do lifting big stones, they'll do playing ball games for strength and to kind of shape the body into this image that they see in all of the art that they've got. Because all of those, you know, you can go to any museum that has ancient stuff and you'll see what appears to be a billion beautiful statues of women and men and gods and goddesses, but that's only some of the ones that survive. They're absolutely right. plastered. And then there's painting as well, which is often mythological, and so much of it is an ideal body type that they're all striving for.
Speaking of not ideal body types, but sort of an idealistic depiction of something, the frieze that we talked about that shows the everyday person in the forum, obviously not very naturalistic, but sort of authentic.
Yeah.
What challenges do you as a historian face when you try to interpret this imagery in, for example, in this frieze, especially then in relation to the gender roles or social hierarchies in Roman society? Because, I mean, earlier and in your book, you mentioned the middle classes, which, you know, is a modern term that's that we try to use for ancient societies, which is sort of a point of contention, I think, in your field. How would you define a middle class as depicted in the Forum Frieze? Or would you say that it is the middle class that's depicted in this Forum Frieze?
I'll be honest, I use it as a kind of slightly, this is the joy of not being an academic, so I don't have to be that precise, as a kind of slightly lazy shorthand for readers to kind of get what I am going for, which right. is a class of people who work in and engage in commerce, basically, but are not necessarily working in either physical labor, or in the ancient world, it would be mostly like agriculture or doing what it's not unskilled labor, but basically doing physical labor. So it is people who are working within commerce or trade or what might be called kind of creative industries. And it is, I kind of call it a middle class, because very often when we talk about the Roman world, we talk about senators and then we talk about the equestrians. And because we're often looking at that from the senatorial perspective, we forget that the equestrians are still very much the elite. They are, there's still a very small number of them. So if there's maybe 400 families, 600 families that are senatorial, then there's not that much more than that who are on the equestrian level. And that those classes are formal, like there are lists of people who belong to that class, and you can have your name taken off of that list if you fail to meet the criteria to be part of that class. Like, class in the Roman world is very, very, at the top, is very weirdly hierarchical and written down. Like, it's very formalized. And then beyond that, you tend to think of them as a bit of an amorphous blob of people who are very often presented as all being uniformly kind of very poor and a grubby. And if they get talked about, they tend to get talked about in talking about like the corn dole, or about giving out prizes, or about a kind of blob of people who are at games. And they tend to get represented in, certainly in modern literature and in TV and film and things like that, as being gross, unemployed, largely very dirty, very often with their boobs out for some reason.
Just normal. Like,
yeah. And they are kind of grotesque. And so this level of what I call the middle class, which is just people who work in industries that they earn money, they're not on the corn dole, they're not unemployed wasters rolling around, they are citizens or non-citizens who are things like blacksmiths and jewelers and stonemasons and fullers and butchers and all of the other jobs that you need to keep a city running and keep an urban environment going and fed and with all of the things that it needs, and who make a living off of that, but are often completely invisible.
And I think that is, you know, apart from the fact that we have here a sort of a big building that is owned by a woman, which to our understanding of how, you know, the ancient Roman society worked is something very surprising. We also have this, where we have sort of the example of how this type of middle class would have worked. But it also probably shows that, you know, within the middle class, that it's not, it might be quite homogenous in Pompey, because Pompey's quite special in that regard. But but generally, this type of middle class might go from extremely poor to wealthier than an equestrian, for example.
Yeah.
Being able to, I don't know, put up a huge tomb next to the city gate or something like this in order to show your wealth.
Which they do. Yeah. Or the baker in Augustan Rome, who has this enormous tomb that he built himself that is in the shape of a baking oven, like a hive oven. And then it has all of these depictions of his life on the outside. And he started life as a slave. And then he got his freedom. And then he built up this enormous bakery, feeding a big chunk of the city, and was obviously famous enough for his bread. And he has all of these images of his bakery around the outside. But he had enough money to do this, but he would never be eligible to be an equestrian or a senator because he's a freedman. And so he would be considered to be kind of one of the middle classes, even though he's obviously preposterously well off.
So there is a sort of social mobility, just not when it comes to sort of the status roles of ancient. So if you can't, you know, it's very difficult. Or is it possible to become an equestrian when you're really rich?
If you are very rich and you are not, and you and your parents basically have never engaged in what would be considered low professions, which is acting, prostitution, and music's okay, being a gladiator, or as long as neither of your parents were enslaved and you meet the kind of moral criteria as well, so you've not been convicted of a crime or anything, then you can basically be given the rights of an equestrian. You can be considered part of the equestrian class. You need 400,000 sesterces. And if you have that, then you can be granted the right. And then from that, you or your children could be, if you get 1,000,000 sesterces and you have friends in high places, then you can be inducted into the Senate and reach the senatorial rank.
But how much would 1,000,000 sesterces, like, what should we imagine? How much is it?
Like a lot. So
I mean, it sounds a lot, but
yeah,
I mean, would
it
that
does sound
feed
a lot.
10 families for 10 years or?
So the general, the only way that we can really work it out is from the price lists that were released by Diocletian, where he says, like, this is what certain things should cost. And from that, he basically said that an average wage should be, for a day, should be 7 sesterces. So if you were to hire yourself out for a job, it should be about 7 sesterces a day. So if you say that's an average, kind of, you can live on that. And bread, I can't remember what bread costs, but it costs a fraction of that, then you can say that, yeah, so it's a good, it's like 10 or so years worth of an average wage that you have to have in one, be able to prove in one go that you have, and take the papers down to the right office and say, can I come in, please?
I mean, from the sounds of it, even for a very wealthy baker, that's a lot of money. I mean,
it is a lot of money.
If he, even if he'd not been a freedman, he'd still be, you know, it'd still be almost impossible for him.
Yeah. And then you would need the, you then have to spend the money to keep up the appearances of your peers. So,
and at some point you're wondering, why am I even bothering?
Yeah.
I've had a good life. I'm wealthy. People like me.
It's, yeah. And now I've got this expectation and there's certain things I'm not allowed to do, because once you become a senator or you, get banned from doing all kinds of things that are considered not honourable. So for some people, it's not worth it.
Since you mentioned the keeping up appearances, one interesting aspect when I read about the frieze is that the fact that there's so few people there wearing togas, I saw one interpretation was that, you know, maybe there were more that had the status to wear them, but it's just too hot, so they don't wear them.
Yeah.
And that's why they're portrayed like this.
They are a pain to wear. They're massive. And people will also make fun of you. Another thing that Marshall makes fun of people for is wearing what he considers to be ratty or overly light togas. They're like cheap. But if you've got a good toga, then it's about 2 meters of wool or of heavy fabric that is draped around just so. And you have to keep it out of the mud and you have to carry it. And it's hot in Italy a lot of the time. And I wouldn't want to wear basically a big woolen blanket while walking around Pompeii in the middle of the day.
Yeah. Which is interesting because if we believe this interpretation, then it's another sign that you had certain things that you were supposed to be doing, but not everyone always adhered to it, or most people didn't, because it was just cumbersome.
It's just more effort than it's worth. And you get out, as long as everybody knows that you could be wearing a toga if you wanted to, then
don't make me get my toga.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'll put it on for special occasions, but I'm not.
Right. What do we know about the fate of Julia Felix?
Well, we don't know really much. When her complex was uncovered, they did find a skeleton, which was a female skeleton holding or wearing a lot of jewellery. It was found like in the middle of the gardens and had kind of necklaces and rings and earrings, a lot of which went mysteriously missing in the 70s and 80s. So they're presumably going around on the black market somewhere. Mm-hmm. But so we only have descriptions of them, which is disappointing. But the descriptions are enough to know that they're gold. They have semi-precious gems. And there is more than just a bit of it. This is a person, whoever had it, either looted well or owned a lot of nice jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
And they were heading in the direction of the niche, the altar to Isis that is in the garden, that mm-hmm. is the kind of place where you would keep more valuable things for protection if you were keeping things there.
Mm-hmm.
So one interpretation of that is that this was Julia herself, and that she died there very early on in the eruption, because a lot of people died from being hit on the head
uh-huh.
by falling rocks or fell and suffocated. Another interpretation, of course, is that it's a very unlucky looter. and Julia got out, but
yeah.
It is certainly possible that she died in her complex. I said in the book that I thought it was sort of quite nice that she went down with her ship, but my editor was like, would it not have been nicer if she escaped and lived a happy life?
I suppose, it's not poetic yeah. enough.
It's not really, I mean, it would technically, I guess, be nicer if she went yeah. off and lived a nice life, but poetically,
the story is much better that way.
Yeah. it's nice to that she's remembered. Like so many people are not remembered at all from the ancient world, but we remember her because of the pure luck of the timing of her putting this up for rent. And so it feels, yeah, poetic mm-hmm. and narratively satisfying if she also was still there until the 1970s.
Very much so. Emma, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about the book and about Julia Felix especially, and about the great things that her big compound and the frieze tell us about this time, as much open to interpretation as it may be.
Yeah.
It's a lot to interpret, and I think that's really fascinating.
It is, and there's so much to her complex. And if people go to Pompeii, I highly recommend visiting it. I don't know that a lot of people go there. I went to Pompeii earlier this year and there were not a huge amount of people in it. And the tour guide that was taking people around was incorrect about what he was telling people. So if you go around with a tour guide and tour guide tells you that you're looking at bedrooms when you're looking at shops, then you'll be able to tell him that they are not clearly not bedrooms.
Did you not get a private tour from Sophie Hay?
I didn't, because I was only there for about 4 hours and I did not have time, and it was on a Sunday and nobody was at work. So I missed out, and I also didn't get to see Gabriel, who is the director there now, who mm-hmm. is the reason that so much wonderful stuff is now coming out, because mm-hmm. he's reinvigorated the investigation. But hopefully I'm going to go back at the end of this year when it's a bit cooler and get to see Sophie and Gabriel and go and see all of the fun new stuff that they're pulling out.
Amazing. Yeah, they've pulled out quite a bit in the last couple of years. Like, I remember, yeah. wasn't it last year that they uncovered the pizza? Which
yes.
they said it's a pizza, but it could be, you know, interpretation.
You know, it's a pizza without a tomato sauce, but yes,
yeah.
A white pizza maybe. and they found another bakery actually, which still had chains in it, and a lot of really fascinating stuff to do with the very, very poor, about enslaved people and the people and workers and things that they're starting to publicize a lot more than they have mm-hmm. in previous decades. So yeah, it's loads of really exciting stuff coming out.
Yeah, I gotta add this to my already very long list of places to visit.
it is amazing, I have to yeah. say. It doesn't matter how many times you go, it is still just so impressive to see how big it is and how complex it is as a space, and how much the way that we talk about the Roman world is often so flattening of what it actually was as a place where people lived and worked and played and wrote weird graffiti on the wall and you probably fell over those cobblestones repeatedly.
Amazing. All right. Thank you for coming on here. If you, dear listener, are interested in reading more, there's 20 other women that we didn't discuss here. in Emma's book. And I think, did I mention it at the beginning? I'm not sure, but your book will be out in German on the 15th of yeah. October.
It is, which I'm really excited about because I haven't had a German translation before. So yeah, amazing. There is going to be a German version, so I'll be available to people. They don't have to read English. I don't know how my jokes will come across in German, but I'm excited to find out.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain you've got a good translator, which I think is sort of the
important
thing here. And if you want to read even more, there's Agrippina, of course, still, and something happened on the way to the forum.
A fatal thing happened on the way to the forum. Yes. Yeah.
So read all of Emma's books. They're amazing.
Thank you. And if you buy them, then they might publish the rest of them in German as well. So
exactly. So we'll just write mails and
please email your local publisher.
Thank you so much. Good luck with your book, which you obviously don't need because it's been a smash hit already.
I'll always take the well wishes. So, and I will come back when I've done the next one.
All right. Looking forward to it already. And to you, dear listener, thank you for listening. And I do not know how to do an outro without the usual one. So let's leave it at that. Goodbye.
Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte. Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte, dann werden Sie sehen, der Reporter, wie das sich damals entwickelt hat.